The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The U.S. Capitol comes under attack.
Immediately tell one of my able staff to bring me a Leatherman that contains a weapon that I can use to defend myself and other senators.
We'll examine why.
When you normalize political violence, you get more political violence.
Later, Democrats suddenly control the U.S. Senate.
There's no way to minimize the impact of that loss in Georgia.
We'll look at what happened in the Peach State.
Trump's attack on Republicans and these allegations of voter fraud not only undermined the candidates, but stepped on their ability to get their message out.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. On Wednesday of this week, thousands gathered in Washington, D.C., protesting what they believed are questionable results in the presidential election. Trump supporters have been consistently peaceful in prior protests. This one did not fit that pattern. Thugs fought past police and barricades in a successful effort to breach the Capitol building. The protest turned into a riot as the activists came prepared to battle. A number of them arrived in protective gear and attacked police. Tragically, one woman was fatally shot. It was clear that the violence came from a distinct subset of the crowd, but violence did come. The Trump crowd did themselves no favors as they cheered on the rioters. It was nothing short of disgraceful on the part of the Trump supporters and was universally condemned by conservatives, many of whom backed the president. I turned to Senator Tom Cotton to discuss the events.
Some senators decided to object to electors reporting they were going to reverse the results. So that meant that we were prepared for a long day after... Objection was raised to Arizona. We returned to the Senate chamber. And the first I heard about any protesters being inside the building was from Mitt Romney. I think you may have seen it on social media. So I immediately told one of my able staff to bring me a Leatherman that contains a weapon that I could use to defend myself and other senators to at least that point. But thankfully, thanks to the very capable Capitol Police that we had on the front lines protecting the perimeter of the Capitol and the Senate chamber and then escorting us, helping some of the frail members to a secure location that was not necessary. But it was chaotic for about 30, 45 minutes or so. But you hate to see the kind of insurrection we saw in the Capitol anywhere, but especially in the seat of our democracy. And as I said last summer, there can be no tolerance for mob violence of any kind. It doesn't matter what kind of slogans they have on their signs when they're marching beforehand, when it descends into violence. It has to be met with the full force of the law.
Senator, the three quickest to condemn the insurrectionists were you, Congressman Michael Waltz, and Congressman Mike Gallagher, all of you combat veterans of Afghanistan and or Iraq. Do you think that's a coincidence, or do you think it comes from having seen the consequence of lawlessness in writ large and in a polity?
Well, yeah, I mean, when you see in Iraq the effects of decades of tyranny or in Afghanistan decades of anarchy, you realize just how fragile civil order can be and what a blessing it is that we live in the United States and we have the world's oldest constitution and the rule of law, and that needs to be defended. And that's why I said last summer and why I said yesterday that mob violence can never be an acceptable form of political action, and that as soon as it becomes a mob, it has to be stopped immediately.
Now, you noted 2 days ago that you did not support the objections to the electors. I noted the same thing in the Washington Post. At the same time, those who were issuing those objections were following a well-trod path from 2004 and 2016. On the record, did they do anything lawless themselves?
No, they did not. They did something deeply unwise, and they misled their own supporters and gave them false hope that somehow this was going to affect the results of the election, when, as we saw yesterday, there was zero chance of that ever happening. Nancy Pelosi's Democratic House was not going to reverse the results of an election that elected a Democratic president. You're right that the Democrats are pretty hypocritical about acting as if filing those objections with some kind of unprecedented unprecedented breach of norms. It's so unprecedented to you that the Democrats have only done it every time a Republican has won the presidency this century. those senators, again, I think for political gain in the short term, gave their supporters false hope and misled them that something would happen that would reverse the results of election or even create some kind of emergency audit of the election results. None of that was ever going to happen. A much sounder course would be to propose the kind of independent commission that I have and Senator McConnell and Senator Tim Scott have to evaluate all of the novel voting practices from last year's election to ensure that we can have sound elections with integrity in the future.
Is it necessary for conservatives, rule of law conservatives today, to focus exclusively or at least predominantly on what happened yesterday and to avoid whataboutism?
Well, see, what I'd say the focus is better put on what's going to happen in 13 days when Joe Biden is sworn in and the Democrats have a majority, narrow majorities, but a majority nonetheless in the House and the Senate along with the vice president, and what it means to America if we don't get organized to stop their radical agenda. However, as I said, the kind of violence you saw in the Capitol, the kind of violence you saw in the streets last summer is never acceptable. People can protest and demonstrate all they want, but it can never turn into violence. And if it does, it has to be met with the full force of the law.
As the mayhem settled and order was restored in what really is the centerpiece of our great democratic experiment, our vice president made a clear and unequivocal statement restoring order.
To those who wreaked havoc in our Capitol today, you did not win. Violence never wins. Freedom wins. And this is still the people's house. And as we reconvene in this chamber, the world will again witness the resilience and strength of our democracy. For even in the wake of unprecedented violence and vandalism at this Capitol, the elected representatives of the people of the United States have assembled again on the very same day to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. So may God bless the lost, the injured, and the heroes forged on this day. May God bless all who serve here and those who protect this place. And may God bless the United States of America. Let's get back to work.
I turn to former Senator Jim Talent, who used to represent Missouri in the Congress.
When you normalize political violence, you get more political violence. And I was thinking back to Melissa Click in the University of Missouri almost 5 years ago. We've been ignoring this stuff, excusing it, not prosecuting it. And yesterday the president incited it, and we got it. And I just hope that everybody now begins to take it seriously. I'd like to see the president-elect at an appropriate time not only condemn violence in general, but just say, look, it's wrong no matter who does it. And nobody around the country, no chief executive, Republican or Democrat, should tolerate this or excuse it. You have to move in, arrest people according to the orderly processes of the law as soon as it happens. And if you don't, it grows. And I hope he'll do that. I think there's a chance now he will.
Now, Senator Talent, incitement is a crime, and I've avoided using it in connection with the president because under Brandenburg v. Ohio, you have to have the intent to incite imminent lawless action. Do you think the president had the intent to incite that?
Well, I don't know. I did not use it in the legal sense.
Okay.
Maybe I should have used the word encouraged or, you know, in other words,
recklessly disregarded or negligently allowed.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
The incitement language has got very specific. It's charge the building and then you can be charged. And I see incitement being used and I don't like it, but I do believe he was negligent.
Yeah. I mean, because look, when you get people like this and people have been seeing this happen. I mean, every few days I look at Andy Ngo's Twitter and, you know, he keeps track of this going on around the country. And I said it 4.5 years ago. You know, Tom Cotton writes an op-ed. Now, we can argue about whether federal authority should have been used in the way Tom said. But he writes an op-ed that says basically this stuff is very dangerous and the executive authorities need to take it extremely seriously. And the people who print the op-ed are fired.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's you know, you remember what C.S. Lewis said. You know, we scoff at honor and then we're surprised to find traitors in our midst. So everybody needs to get really serious about this now.
And the rule of law is neither left nor right. If you violate it, you need to be prosecuted.
Yeah, absolutely. And people need to see that happening on a neutral basis. Okay,
so,
because if you don't, yeah. If
and
you
so I don't want to merge the two events, but the Antifa in Seattle, there was a murder inside the Antifa settlement in Seattle, and there was a murder inside the Capitol yesterday. I believe those murders are the responsibility of the people who set up the encampment in Antifa and the people who stormed the Capitol yesterday. Do you agree with me?
Sure. And listen, if you don't, the reason I make, I'm not trying to do whataboutism or something like, what I'm saying is if you don't, if the responsible authorities and the influencers don't enforce standards, at least make an honest attempt to enforce standards on an equal basis, the message they're sending is the standards really don't matter. What matters is who's doing it. And when you do that, eventually, you know, you're going to get more of it.
I agree. Now, Senator, I got to ask you about Capitol Police, because you know them. You served there in both houses, both as a representative and as a senator. How were they so quickly overwhelmed? You know they're professionals. I've dealt with them for years.
Well, you know, I think it's because when you get large numbers of people intent on violence and disorder and anarchy, it is very difficult to control. This is why you want to stop it at the beginning. I mean, now, yes, there'll be some investigation, and maybe they should have been better prepared. But this gets really hard once it gets to these levels. Yes, it does. And it takes a lot to stop it. So that's why you want to stop it at. That's the rule of dealing with mobs, is as soon as they cross the line, as soon as they throw the first rock at the first police car, you swoop in and arrest the people, and that stops it. If you don't do that, it tends to grow because mobs get empowered. They realize, well, they're not going to open up. They're not going to open fire on us like this was some kind of a battle. And, no. And if they did, I mean, that's Kent State, right? I mean,
yes. You know. A quick question, Senator. People made objections yesterday, including the senator who may hold your seat, Josh Hawley. I do not object to their objecting. I would not have objected myself. I wrote that in the Post. But what they were doing is legal and legitimate and has precedent. Do you fault them for it?
Well, I wouldn't have done it because I don't think the basis was there to do it. But they were pursuing the normal processes. I don't think
that's
we should say at all that they you know, people do things, you know, cast votes I disagree with all the time and take actions I disagree with. They were pursuing the normal processes, and they were entitled to do that. And, of course, there's precedent for doing that. So that wasn't the reason this happened, okay? This happened because if you want to say we weren't as prepared for this particular incident as we should have been, but because we have been acculturating people to the idea of it.
Coming up.
There's no way to minimize the impact of that loss in Georgia.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. What happened in Georgia does not stay in Georgia. Republicans lost both the Senate seats that you may have heard me talking about so much for these past 2 months. The loss grants Democrats the power they seek in the Senate. The brakes are off the wagon and the hill they are on is steep. While Republicans aren't entirely helpless, Democrats can now do a tremendous amount of damage without a single Republican vote. They will control the committees. They will set the calendar. They will decide which bills get introduced. From raising taxes to the extreme Green New Deal, the party that has been lurching leftward has 2 years to advance their dangerous agenda before voters again have any say. Following the Georgia results, I spoke with Eliana Johnson of the Washington Free Beacon. Eliana, tell me what you think about Georgia, where the Republicans lost two Senate seats and thus the entire Congress to the Dems.
It certainly looks that way now, and I think there are a few factors at play. One is the relatively weak Republican candidates. The second is the media doing what it could to ease the path for Democrats and not covering them particularly aggressively. But I think there are two ways to look at it. The first is Trump's attack on Republicans and these allegations of voter fraud. not only undermined the candidates, but stepped on their ability to get their message out. And I'm sure we'll hear from Trump's fans that this just shows Republicans needed Trump on the ballot, because he was on the ballot in November. And, you know, Perdue, who was in a one-on-one then, performed better 2 months ago than he did right now.
But of course, turnout was down among Republicans, and it was up among Democrats. Their percentage of the electorate increased, the Republican percentage declined. So this civil war definitely had an impact. I always tell people, just use some common sense. The governor, Brian Kemp, even if he's wildly unpopular, is still going to have 20% of the state that is fiendishly loyal to him. And they're mad. They're not going to show up. And Kelly Loeffler is not a good candidate. And back to when Kemp put Kelly Loeffler in that job, she's a rookie candidate. So I just want to look forward, though, Eliana. If you're a Republican, there's never been a better time to start running for office in 2022, is there?
Senate control will be on the ballot again in 2022. I think you're right. You know, another factor here, Hugh, is this wasn't all about Republicans. It was a little bit about Democrats, too. And I think this is a triumph for Stacey Abrams, who is the queen bee of the Democratic establishment in Georgia, has led these huge get out the vote efforts for Democrats, particularly African-Americans, and made this bet that Warnock was the right candidate. He was by no means the default candidate in that race, but she bet on him. He was the more controversial candidate and looks to have performed better than the kind of establishment vanilla Democrat John Ossoff.
Now the question is, can they persuade Pat Toomey to run again? Can they persuade Chris Sununu to run not for governor but for Senate? Can they recruit? Will it be easy for the Republicans to recruit into this situation, Eliana Johnson?
I don't know right now. And I think, I think people are making a lot of assumptions about what the dynamics in the party will be post-Trump. And I actually think we just can't, for me at least, I don't have any certainty about what those will be. I think it's going to take 6 months or a year to see what Trump's staying power is. One question is, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, do he and his people go to war against Trump and try to marginalize him? And if they do, what impact does that have on the political dynamics within the party? Because I think it's tough for people to want to join, to want to run for office in a party that's at war with itself.
In a normal year, in a normal election, two conservatives should easily defeat two extremists from the left in the southern state of Georgia. So what happened? Congressman Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. So how grim are the next 2 years going to be?
I think very grim, very grim. There's no way to minimize the impact of that loss in Georgia. I do think, however, Hugh, as any time you suffer a loss, we're going to have to spend some time looking in the mirror and confront some very hard truths about why we lost. I mean, this is my sort of initial take, and I'd be curious to get yours. I think in some ways, Perdue and Loeffler were robbed of their most effective closing argument, which is that they would act as a check and balance on a highly progressive Biden administration, in part because they could not concede that a Biden administration would exist. And I can't help but think that that muddled the message. And if the lesson we derive from this instead is, oh, no, the same, you know, corrupt Republican officials that fixed the presidential election, fixed this election, I'm just not sure we're going to understand exactly what happened, because I feel like part of the reason we lost suburban voters in Georgia as the initial numbers, and again, this is very early in the process, early in the autopsy, part of the reason some Republicans stayed home is because of that relentless message of, oh, it's rigged, it's stolen, it's rigged, it's stolen. I really feel like we're going to have to have a very difficult discussion within the party over the next few months so that we're in a position to win the House back in 2022, which is job one, defend Senate seats like the one that's up in Wisconsin in 2022. But we're going to have to have that discussion sooner rather than later.
Well, I agree with you 100%. I think if the party embraces grievance and conspiracy, it will dwindle. And if it goes back to embracing opportunity and national security, it will thrive. And I've done this three times. I was alive in the 60s when it was all Democrats. I was alive in Carter when it was all Democrats. When it was Clinton, all Democrats. And 2 years of Obama, all Democrats. And you get the best year after this. 2022 is the best year to be a young Republican running for the House. I do want Pat Toomey, if you see him in the hallways of Congress, to change his mind and run for reelection. I'm not sure about Ron Johnson and whether he ought to give way. I leave that to the Wisconsinites, but probably not. I don't know Wisconsin well enough. But I do believe in recruiting for 2022. We need young veterans, including communities of color. We do not need old white guys, and we do not need newbies. We need young veterans to be. It's going to be the greatest year ever to run. The redistricting is going to favor us. We ought to win the House in 2 years. Do you agree with that?
It's ours to lose, I would say. And we did a great job. Honestly, the Democrats in 2018 smartly recruited a lot of young Democrats, female candidates, and they took a lot of Trump districts. We did the same here in 2020. We made remarkable gains in the House. These are great candidates from diverse backgrounds, a lot of which have military backgrounds. And I think you're absolutely right. That is a formula that we've proven can work. And so I hope Rick Scott at the Senate level, Tom Emmer at the House level, have that in mind. I know Tom Emmer does. And I really just think we have a huge opportunity in 2022. But I do think it kind of gets to the original point, and I know this is not a popular thing to say right now within the party. In my mind, the only way we lose is if we go further down this road of a Republican civil war. I mean, that's kind of what you saw in Georgia, right? You had the governor and Trump fighting with each other and the Secretary of State, and it muddled the message of we cannot give President Biden and the Democratic Party, which is beholden to the far left, a blank check. We need a Republican Senate to act as a check against their power. And I got to tell you, in the first week of the House, Nancy Pelosi has proven with her rules package that they are going to stretch the limits of their power as much as humanly possible, attempting to limit the speech of members, eliminating PAYGO requirements for climate change legislation, the list goes on and on and on. And as you and I have talked about many times before, Hugh, in a chaotic geopolitical environment where the Chinese Communist Party is looking to take advantage of us, there are serious consequences to going down this road.
Coming up, reaction to the pandemic.
They're burning down the house because there's a hornet's nest. Mm-hmm.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Dr. Donald Siegel wrote an article titled Pandemic Response is Our Vietnam. In it, he compares the current crisis to the lead-up to our involvement in the war and the way the government used statistics to keep us engaged. Dr. Siegel explained this in a conversation with Seth Leibson on 960 The Patriot in Phoenix.
It seems to me, in a normal world, and maybe that's the key, but in a normal world, political leaders want to chalk up successes. Less crime, less drug use, less everything bad and more of everything good. And it seems to me that there's this odd thing that has taken place for at least a year now, or at least when it comes to COVID, where a lot of these elected leaders, governors and mayors in particular, are investing in public policy malfeasance, the kinds of things that are going to show increasingly terrible numbers on everything. San Francisco, particularly hard hit by COVID, has 6 times the number of drug overdose deaths this year than COVID deaths. California, you saw, maybe you didn't, but there was this Politico headline about a week ago, locked down California runs out of reasons for surprising surge. These numbers keep going up with COVID, or at least cases do, and yet they keep engaging, these publicly elected leaders keep engaging in what seems to me not just economic, but social suicide of their communities. Is there any explanation for it, or am I overstating the case?
I think people are just focused on one variable.
Okay.
That's the problem.
Okay.
This is a fundamental flaw in the design of this public policy.
Okay.
There was never any analysis of trade-offs. The first thing we teach is that there are trade-offs in decision-making. They've decided to focus on one variable, and they've committed the greatest act of masochism in history in order to, I think the term that I heard used was they're burning down the house because there's a hornet's nest.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm.
And they don't care if they burn down the house, apparently. And you said before that San Francisco's hit by COVID. No. San Francisco is hit by the lockdown
right.
and the quarantine
right.
and the reopenings.
Right.
That's what's destructive, not the actual virus.
Well, that
there
is
aren't
the
that
point
many people
here.
That perished because of the virus in San Francisco.
No, that is the point. That's where I would think. I mean, you know the industry better than I do, and I guess that there will be as much censorship in it as there is on everything else. But it seems to me like classic textbooks could be written on failure of public policy on this one issue.
This is what we said in the essay.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought that there would be a public policy that would be worse than Vietnam, but now we've set a new standard for monumental government failure at all levels, as you point out, not just the federal government. By the way, who's responsible for the most massive government failure at the federal level? It's the same people that are designing the response to the
That's
failure.
That's correct.
The CDC. It's, the,
right.
it's called the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great job.
Mm-hmm. So the thing that I think I pull out of your eight analogies to Vietnam that worries me more than any, and maybe you have a different one, and I'd love to hear it if so, but the one that worries me more than anyone is your third one, I think it is. It's the mission creep part. Because it does seem to me right now, if you listen to our political leaders, there's no end to this thing. We heard about a surge. Now we're hearing about a surge upon a surge. You know, we're hearing about I think you said it. Don't travel. You can't travel even after you get the vaccines. You're hearing from Joe Biden about desires to do things for 100 days. And then they tell us the funniest of all things that must make you really laugh, Professor Siegel, is that this isn't political. This isn't political. It's patriotic. That's the funniest of them all to me. What they're doing by saying that is you can't criticize this. It's basically this is the shutdown of the conversation. When we say this isn't political, it's patriotic. That's like what they were telling us about Vietnam or any other national security.
Well, when
objective.
You have a state-run religion, which mm-hmm. we've established, mm-hmm. But we've had at the same time a concomitant result. Is that we've created a tyrannical public health police state.
Uh-huh.
And they will never give up until we resist, which is what we said at the end of the essay.
Mm-hmm.
It's time for the people to resist and to go back to normal and not abide by these tyrannical restrictions. Just as there was resistance during Vietnam.
Right.
That's the lesson that I would take away, is that if this is like Vietnam, then we need to engage in nonviolent resistance to it at some point. I'm not sure. I think we're getting close to that point, especially if Joe Biden comes in and tries to have a national lockdown, as I suspect he will.
Coming up.
COVID-19 will go away. What won't go away so readily, unless we get really serious, is the hatred and the division, which has a much greater chance of destroying us than the virus.
A prophetic Dr. Ben Carson when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Dr. Ben Carson gained notoriety as one of the world's most competent neurosurgeons. He ran for president in 2016, was a calm voice in the midst of a contentious time. He's now serving as the United States Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Of course, he's soon to depart as President-elect Biden takes office. Dr. Carson spoke with Kevin McCullough on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
Being a part of the coronavirus task force and seeing the way that this country was able to pull together both the private sector and the government to come up with a vaccine in an incredible amount of time. Is it perfect? Is everything perfect? Are all the logistics perfect? Of course they're not. They're never going to be, because you're dealing with people and people aren't perfect.
Yeah.
But it is absolutely phenomenal to see something like that happen, and I think it will help us to conquer the virus. But, you know, COVID-19 will go away. What won't go away so readily unless we get really serious is the hatred and the division, which has a much greater chance of destroying us than the virus.
I just want to focus on a couple of really big ideas. You were brought in to work in the housing department. But as a neurosurgeon, you know a lot about medicine, a lot more than even the average doctor does in so many respects. And I'm just curious on a couple of different levels. If you're examining, you told us just a little while ago that the COVID-19 is going to go away. What is your forecast for what 2021 looks like in terms of how we're dealing with it? What kind of pace are we on? What are your concerns about what maybe we need to tighten up? But where are we at in your assessment of dealing with that crisis?
Well, my biggest concern is that there's been a lot of misinformation passed around so that a significant number of people might not be willing to take the vaccine. And obviously, we're not going to force people to take the vaccine, but that will cause the problem to persist much longer and will result in the death of many more people. That's a significant concern. And some of that is politically motivated. And this is something that we just have to stop doing and use our common sense. Recognize that this vaccine was developed very rapidly. It's sort of a very fortunate thing because they'd been working on the technique for developing vaccines from messenger RNA as opposed to particles of virus for many years. And then this came along at a time when it was, you know, nearing fruition. And so it was almost like a perfect storm. But it required a lot of work and a lot of cooperation between the entities that generally don't work together with each other. So I think that's going to continue to benefit us tremendously. And I think probably by the end of the summer, we will have made very significant progress.
Will we, based on the success of Warp Speed, do you believe that future administrations going forward will be more inclined to do something that they weren't before, and that is to instigate public-private partnerships to do problem solving?
I think public-private partnerships are amazingly effective. And
I mean, that's in essence what the Envision Centers are too as well, right?
Yes, that's exactly what they are. Those are the things that work best. And what I've found is when federal, state, and local government works together with nonprofits, for-profits, and the faith-based organizations, it's like, putting jet fuel in the engine. It really moves a lot faster that way. And there's a lot more money and resources, quite frankly, in the private sector.
Right.
And what we have to recognize about America is not a place. America is an idea. It's an idea about freedom and encouraging people to use their innovation and entrepreneurial skills not only to benefit themselves and their families, but the entire society. That's why we went from a bunch of ragtag militiamen to the premier society in the world in record time.
I seem to remember a certain presidential candidate named Ben Carson that talked about America being an idea in his speeches and debate appearances, and that sounded very familiar to me right there, Dr. Carson. let me stay on the healthcare issue for a second, because once COVID-19 is done and gone, we still haven't solved what a lot of people are saying is the biggest domestic challenge, which I don't know that it is. I think that crime is right now kind of usurping everything else. But let's talk about healthcare for a second. If you had the ability to advise an administration going forward on solving the healthcare crisis, whether it be just talking about reparative coverage or whether we're talking about preventative and ongoing care and different solutions for that, what would you like to see happen in the area of healthcare?
Well, I would like to see us create a system where people have personal responsibility and where they have skin in the game. If you don't have any skin in the game, it's just sort of like you check into a hotel and you put your credit card down. They say, oh, you don't need this. All your expenses are taken care of. What we need to do is have something like healthcare savings accounts where people actually can accumulate their savings if they are wise and if they treat their bodies the right way. Hmm. But you also, in addition to what's traditionally done with healthcare savings accounts, you give people the ability to shift money within their family. So if your wife needed an extra $500, you could give it to her out of yours. And if the whole family then becomes their own little insurance company, everybody's paying a lot closer attention to each other. If Uncle Joe is smoking two cartons of cigarettes a week, everybody's going to be hiding the cigarettes and encouraging them to stop, because that impinges upon the whole family.
I've always wondered why, you know, if my neighbor ate 27 Big Macs a week and had, you know, was obese and had heart disease, why my wife and I, who she tries to cook very organically and healthy and, you know, lots of salads and so forth, why we should have to fund that. And it seemed to me that in the Affordable Care Act and some of the leanings of many of the more progressive people in Congress, their desire is to kind of have that one shoe that fits every foot. And I'm not sure that that's a fair or even American ideal.
It's not the best ideal. And if, you know, if you want to be a lion tamer, then, you know, your insurance should be a little higher cost.
Coming up.
She is not just disingenuous, but she's dangerous. Nothing she says is true.
Charlie Kirk on Vice President-elect Kamala Harris when we return with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, as Congress worked to certify the results of the election, protests turned violent. The Capitol building was breached. We'll take a closer look.
It was the unfolding of a tragedy, the likes of which the United States Capitol has never seen.
And look ahead at the prospects for the economy under a President Biden.
The bad news is a policy shift away from growth.
The new Congress opens with a revealing prayer from Representative Emanuel Cleaver.
A man and a woman.
Carl Truman gives analysis.
Silence is better than blasphemy.
They'll look at the opportunity for Christian witness.
Really, this raises the truth question and the meaning question.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Politicians have a habit of fudging their resumes at times. Usually the bad ones are caught and weeded out. President-elect Biden faced that early in his career. As we can all see, he hung around long enough to survive it. Now it is Vice President-elect Kamala Harris's turn. Here's Salem host Charlie Kirk.
Senator Kamala Harris is now under serious accusations of plagiarism. Nothing new. Says here in this piece in Elle interview, Senator Kamala Harris started her life's work young. Ashley Ford let off the piece. She laughs from her gut. That is not a lie. The way you would with family. As she remembers being wheeled through an Oakland, California civil rights march in a stroller with no straps with her parents and her uncle. At some point, she fell from the stroller and the adults came up in the rapture of protest. Just kept on marching. By the time they noticed little Kamala was gone and doubled back, she was understandably upset. My mother tells me the story about how I'm fussing, Harris told the magazine. And she's like, baby, what do you want? What do you need? And I just look at her and I say, freedom. Interestingly enough, a Twitter user and a contributing editor to the Canadian publication Maclean's noted that Harris's story resembled a similar one that Martin Luther King told that was published in all places Playboy. Okay. I will never forget a moment in Birmingham when a white policeman accosted a little girl, 7 or 8 years old, who was walking in a demonstration with her mother. What do you want? The policeman asked her gruffly, and in the eyes answered, feedum. She couldn't even pronounce it, but she knew it was beautiful. Many times, when it has been in sorely trying situations, the memory of that little one has come into mind and has buoyed me. So there's only a couple explanations to this. Number one, Kamala Harris actually didn't grow up in Oakland, California, and actually in Birmingham, and Martin Luther King was talking about Kamala Harris. Highly unlikely. Second explanation, Kamala Harris was part of an alarming amount of young black women children that felt divinely inspired to look up at their parents and say freedom from all across the country all during the same time. Or explanation number three, the most likely explanation, is that a group of highly paid Washington, D.C. consultants sat down with Kamala Harris and gave her 10 or 12 go-to anecdotes that have been poll tested, not realizing that one of them was publicly published in a magazine back in the 1960s. Remember, that little girl was her, right? But the point is this, is that this is somewhat of a lighthearted story, but it actually goes to show in so many different ways she is not just disingenuous, but she's dangerous. Nothing she says is true.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Pochon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, Harley Eide, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for joining us.